Episode 11, Season 3 of The Bad Apples. My name is Klaatu, and I will be your host today. We're going to talk about a couple of things today. I do have a little bit of a tutorial on, I guess it would be called VNC, is the technical term, Virtual Network Connection. The more popular term, I think, at least in the crowds that I have encountered, would be screen sharing. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. I would also like to talk about integration and interface design, because I have some things to talk about there. Amarok 2.0 has been released. I think that's significant in a couple of different ways, even though I don't actually use the application. I'm going to talk a little bit about, you know, Gmail and Google, and probably some listener feedback, and just various stuff like that, really. So, stay tuned, and let's get started soon. So, yeah, let's see how many takes it takes me to do this segment, but, so Amarok 2.0 was released, I think about 6 hours ago. And it's kind of cool because this is a very, very popular music player. In the Linux world, from what people have told me, you know, the sense that I get is that this is sort of the music player for Linux. You know, it does everything that you'd want a music player to do, and it does it really, really well. I do not use it. But then I don't use any graphical music player. I hate graphical music players, and I always have. Even before I went to Linux, when I was using Mac, you know, the players that I would use were things that were not so reliant upon the graphical stuff. You know, it'd be more like just, okay, open a window, dump the music you want into the playlist, and press play. And that's all I want my music player to do. So I don't actually use Amarok. But I respect it for what it is, and I respect it for being a good music player, for being versatile, for being robust. And the new one that was released is, you know, it's redesigned. All the frameworks have been shifted from 3.5 KDE3 stuff to the KDE4 frameworks. It's using some of the core KDE technologies like Solid and Phonon and Plasma and all that other good stuff. So it is completely redesigned and rewritten and everything like that. And just like any other KDE app, it's highly configurable and customizable. And in my opinion, the interface, while complex, is also fairly intuitive, in fact. And this led me to think about certain things regarding interface design and what we would call intuitive interface design. And I will say that this is a pretty complex issue. Figuring out how a computer and a person are going to successfully meet together and work together on something as easily as possible is tough. It's not easy because humans do weird things. Humans are fickle, they're complex, and each one is just a little bit different in terms of what they expect or in terms of what they've learned or what they're capable of doing or whatever. And so when you think about interface design, there are a couple of different things that you have to think about. One of those things is what people are used to already, you know, so basically the past interfaces or the past experiences someone has had with computers or with whatever kind of application you are doing, that you are trying to, you know, introduce to them as an alternative or a new way of doing something. Whatever you're offering them, they're bringing to the table with them a lot of past experience. So if you say, here is, for instance, a photo editor, such as the GIMP, perhaps, then you're automatically, if you say that this is a photo editor and they come toward it and they, you know, automatically they're thinking about whatever photo editor they've previously used. So some people might have used, you know, Microsoft Paint or whatever the photo, you know, whatever editing application is on a PC. Or maybe they've used Photoshop, or maybe they've used I think it was called Photo Deluxe by Adobe. It was like before Photoshop Elements came out, there was like some other horrible editing application that they used to give away for free with scanners and things like that. So whatever this person's learned already, they're bringing with them so that they have a point to start out from. So if your application is different than what they're expecting, it automatically becomes, in their mind, harder, or more often, less intuitive, quote unquote. This is one of the major issues I have with people telling me that GIMP is not as intuitive or as well-designed of an interface as Photoshop is. Barring little nitpicks here and there, which probably can tolerate some improvement, because GIMP is a work in progress, and it's fine that there are improvements needing to be made, to be sure. Barring things like that, the overall design of GIMP is in no way bad at all. In fact, in some ways, it's more logical. It makes more sense. And then in other ways, of course, you think, well, gee, maybe the Photoshop method would have been better here. Obviously, it depends. But my point is that simply because someone approaches it and isn't familiar with it doesn't mean that it's not as intuitive. It simply means that they've got a map printed in their mind from something that they've already learned, and they're trying to superimpose it on this new application rather unfairly. And if you think about it, just because they were introduced to one photo editing application before another one doesn't mean that the first one that they got introduced to is the right way of doing things. And people say this a lot of times, you know, they often compare GIMP to Photoshop rather than, for instance, Photoshop to GIMP. And I was talking to someone, so the thing is about Photoshop is that if you're a Photoshop wizard, then you didn't just sit down at Photoshop CS4 and just start doing your magic on photos. You started out, first of all, probably on an earlier version with less features, fewer features, and you started out by reading a book on the subject, maybe one of those Adobe Press Classroom in a Book books, or maybe you went to school for it, or maybe you had someone who was really good at it and they showed you, you know, all the tricks that they knew. My point, obviously, is that you trained for the knowledge that you've got right now. So going to GIMP without any kind of expectation of, gee, I should sit down and read the manual, or I should go out to a bookstore and buy a book on the GIMP and see how things are done in this program, because certain decisions were made that are different, and in some cases they're actually really helpful, but they might confuse you, and so you might think, oh, well, this is backwards. Well, no, it's not backwards, it's just different. So this is an issue that I have with people bringing past experience to something new. And even on the proprietary side of things, you don't see people who have been trained in, for instance, Avid, the video editor Avid, which for many years was the industry standard. And then now that the industry is switching heavily over to Final Cut Pro, you don't see these people who know everything about Avid coming over to Final Cut Pro and just picking it up. They're getting trained on it. They're reading books, or they're going to lessons, or whatever they need to do to see what the differences are. So the argument of, well, a photo editor should be a photo editor should be a photo editor, or a video editor should be a video editor should be a video editor, while it holds true for the general concepts, it does not hold true for the software, the specifics of the software.
Now, to be fair, it's also something that one should consider when designing interfaces, I think, because if you are developing a program and you know that a well-established program already exists, number one, why are you developing the program? Well, probably it's a proprietary program and you're developing the free version, so you're basically doing an alternative, a direct competitor. Now, if you're doing that and you expect people and you expect to compete, I mean, there is a certain degree of compatibility, I guess, or cross compatibility in terms of knowledge that you do probably want to take into consideration, unless you simply have the great new way of doing something. I mean, if you've really got a revolutionary way of doing something, then okay. But I mean, if you think about it, like Intel, for instance, and I don't know if this is true, but Intel was in the CPU market, right? They're making chips. Well, AMD entered the market, and they didn't do a completely different kind of, you know, microprocessing. They were x86 compatible. And that made them be a competitor to Intel, a viable competitor, because obviously introducing a completely new, completely incompatible way of doing things is kind of sort of market suicide in a lot of cases. So if that's the case, if that's the scenario, for instance, GIMP to Photoshop, you do want to kind of keep that in mind and keep in mind that people are bringing past experiences. And there's probably a lot of those past experiences and expectations are very rational, because a program that has been around for a long time, like Photoshop, is obviously doing something right. Believe me, I account a lot of Photoshop's success to, you know, marketing and the fact that it kind of got into the industry early and got adopted by major players and they just got lucky, whereas, you know, whatever applications were out there at the same time did not. Maybe part of that was because of the interface. Maybe it was just good marketing. I don't know. But it's hung around for a long time, and it seems like it probably is doing something right. Using that knowledge only makes sense. Another thing that one has to take into consideration, I think, is a user's reasonable expectation of how something would be done or should be done. And this breaks down itself into two separate issues, I think. There's one, sort of the logical flow of things, of the workflow, and then there's another, what people are used to on that system. And that's going to get into a little bit of integration, so I'll save that for a moment. So what people, the workflow of your application would be how the application, I mean, there applications, some of them are very, very up in the air. And I mean, in fact, I could say GIMP. I mean, in a way, that's an application where the workflow is really going to differ from project to project, from person to person. There's just not, you know, you're going to open a picture first, or probably, and even there, I mean, right there, actually, not necessarily, you might be creating something from scratch. So you're going to be creating a canvas first, let's say that's for sure. But then who knows what you're going to do? So there's not really a flow. But in some applications, for instance, like a video editor, a video converter, there would be a definite workflow. You need to choose the source media, you need to choose the attributes that you want it to have, and then you need to choose the output file. And that's the workflow, and there's not a whole lot more that you can do about it. So an application designed to do this would, you know, logically, at least in the Western world, be sort of a flow from left to right, or maybe top to bottom, and it would be, you know, I wouldn't think you would need to go into many menus. You should probably just have like a container so that you can define the file that you want to convert, or the batch list of files that you want to convert, and you will want maybe a browse button there so that they can go into their file system and find that file. And then you could also give them the option to drag and drop. It's always nice. And then you would give them the choices of what formats you are supporting and the different attributes of each of those formats, frame rates and bit rates and things like that. And then you would give them an area to define either the output file or the regular expression, as it were, for the output files if it's a batch list. And that would be sort of your application, and that would make sense. And I have seen applications which are programmed far better than I could ever program them, since I can't program, so I can't really critique them. But in terms of interface design, you know, I've seen programs that is just baffling as to, like, the workflow is just not obvious. You know, there's so many menus, so many tabs, so many buttons, you know, and you have no idea what to do first or how they relate. You know, is this a button that relates to the input file, or is this button that relates to the output file? Am I defining what I have or what I want to have? Really, really confusing stuff. So ideally, there would be a sense of sort of logical expected workflow. There's also the question of consistency, and this gets into the whole issue of integration. And this is a good one. This is really interesting stuff to me, because consistency kind of plays into what people are used to, you know, their past experiences. But there's also a certain degree of, you know, okay, so here's this application, and we know that there are going to be a certain number of buttons that people are going to have to press at different stages during the application. You know, an office suite would be a good example of this. You figure, okay, there are lots of different components here. There's a spreadsheet, a word processor, a presentation, and whatever else. Well, people are going to be opening files and saving files, and maybe they're going to be printing things a lot, emailing things straight out of, maybe converting to PDF and then emailing straight out of the application. Whatever. I don't really use Office Suites I don't really know what people do with them, but that's sort of some things I've seen. Obviously, if you're going to have dialog boxes come up for similar but different things, then you would want to keep the layout of those dialog boxes very, very consistent, so that the OK button or the, you know, submit button or whatever is in the same location every time. And you would want to keep the buttons that choose, you know, going back one folder to the parent folder or whatever, that would be consistent with each other. But then there's a whole other level, and hopefully, I mean, an office suite, I'm sure that most office suites do. I mean, I'm sure they even can just reuse the same dialog box, so I'm sure that's something that's being implemented. But it goes deeper, because I think that what certain applications get into is, okay, well, how does this application do it versus a music player? You know, like something completely different. You've got your office app, and then you've got a music player. No relation between those two things at all. And yet, the user, there is a relation. The relation is the user. They're the common link. They're the person going to be using the Office app and the music app. And so wouldn't it be nice if, when the music app suddenly pops up a dialog box and says, would you like to, you know, save the ID3 tags that you've just changed? Shouldn't the OK button be in the same place as when they were being asked if they wanted to save something on the Office app, for instance? And I'm using a really simple example of the OK button. But imagine, for instance, something that I see a lot of times across Linux apps, is going to the parent folder. You know, you're browsing through your file system, you realize you've gone down one too many folders, you just want to go back one. And then you'll look up in the left corner, and oh, it's not there, okay, how do I get back? Oh, it's over here on the side panel, okay. So you go back one, and then you look up in the right-hand corner on a different one, and or the left-hand corner, and there's different arrows. There's a back arrow and an up arrow. And you're like, well, I want to go back one, but aren't I really going up? And then in another application, there's just a left arrow to go back one folder. You know, and it's just completely different layout, completely different buttons, you know, and you're just, it's just enough to kind of make you stop and think about it, you know? It's not a big deal at all, but if we're striving for, you know, perfection in interface design and stuff like that, that would be the kind of thing that we would want to address, I think. And as many people have pointed out, I know, Linux is a pastiche, a buffet of many different people's ways of doing things, so consistency would be very hard to achieve, because you would have to get everyone designing these interfaces to say, yes, this is how we're going to do it. And number one, that might not be a good idea, because that might not be the best way to do it. And number two, it's just logistically, it's very difficult. However, I think there are certain things that people could keep in mind, and I know that there are people striving to promote this, like Celeste from the KDE project, and the entire, you know, the whole GNOME human interface guidelines. So, you know, there are people really actively pursuing this kind of thing, and they're doing a lot more work than I am, certainly, on it. So, you know, and I think that's great, and I'm very impressed with that, and I'm not critiquing interface design of Linux, I'm simply giving some thoughts about it. And now I'm going to praise a certain project for all of the integration that they have implemented, and that is, of course, KDE. And it's not exclusive to KDE, because GNOME is doing the same, a very similar thing. I don't think GNOME, from my impression, is quite as far along with the idea. But I could be wrong on that, because I don't use a whole lot of GNOME apps, and I don't use GNOME itself that much, so I could be wrong. But from what I've seen, at least in KDE, which, you know, as it's my primary desktop on a couple of different machines, and if it's not that, if I'm not using KDE desktop, I'm generally using some KDE apps. So what I have seen is that KDE is famously striving for a lot of integration between their different applications. And, you know, that's the reason that they're doing things like KOffice, Krita. Oh yeah, well, there's Console and Conqueror and Dolphin, and what else do I use? Well, yeah, and even Amarok. I mean, you know, Amarok, Ocular, you know, just all these different applications, KDN Live, just all these different kinds of applications that are under the KDE banner, and are seeking and striving to unify their design and the way that they function and the frameworks that they use, so that the user gets a very, very integrated and yet diverse, because it's by so many different people, but it's a very integrated environment in which they can work. And I think that's an exciting goal. I think it's something that, you know, the Linux desktop really needs. I think that that's the kind of thing that, for a user experience, while it's not necessary at all, I mean, really, it's not at all, and I know that, and I think a lot of people know that, and that's why it's not quite getting a whole lot of attention, but it is a nice thing. It's cool to have some integration there so that whenever something pops up, you don't really have to think too hard about what it's asking you or where to click. It's just kind of like, there it is, this is what you do, buttons in the right place, workflow makes sense, etc., etc. Those are my thoughts on integration and interface design. And you know what? Here's an idea. Not that anyone's going to hear this except my 11 listeners, but if there's a programmer out there who needs help on interface design, feel free to email me. I will help you on interface design, and that way I'm at least not just rambling here. I'm actually offering some kind of service. So for real, if there's any kind of programmer out there who is doing an interface and isn't sure how it should be laid out, or you know, isn't really quite feeling that they've got graphic skills or whatever, what graphic skills I do have, I would gladly contribute to any application out there, because I think that would be a lot better than just talking about it. So keep that in mind. If you know a programmer who needs help on interface design or whatever, send them to me. I will review the, you know, if it's a GNOME app, I'll review the GNOME HIG. I've read it once. I will review it again. If it's a KDE app, I will, I don't think they actually have a HIG, but I will go off of the KDE apps that I do use and strive to make it as similar as possible. Unfortunately, I have no programming skills, so I don't even know how to do it, but I will do what I can. So there you go. That interface discussion went on a lot longer than I thought. Sorry about that. But I do have more to say, but not about interface design, so don't worry. It's about Google, Gmail, things like that. When I first got into podcasting, everyone practically, you know, that I was listening to had a Gmail account. And I, you know how it is when you're first starting something, you look at everyone else and who is doing that thing, and you're like, okay, well, I'll just emulate them, and that's how I become what they are. So I ended up getting a Gmail account just because I thought it would be a nice consolidated area for, you know, people to email me at, just in relation to this podcast. Okay, so little did I know that I was going to be podcasting a lot and that I was going to meet so many people through podcasting. So I kind of got myself kind of locked into Gmail, right? And when what do you mean locked into Gmail? You know, I mean, it's free. You can leave any time, right? Well, incredibly, you can't really, because the way that these companies, in case you didn't know, do it is, you know, you use their service, and suddenly all your data that you might actually find useful at some point lives in their little cloud. So there's all these emails with, like, really interesting information or just a whole contact list of, you know, different people that I've met through this podcast. You know, everyone listening who has ever emailed me is in there, you know. You know, people are in my chat, you know, Mark and David and Doug and Nicholas and Russ and, you know, Enigma and, you know, Alk3. And I mean, just all these people that Aaron Finnan, you know, I mean, all these people who have emailed me from a Gmail account are in my Gmail chat list, you know, and then all their emails with all the information about, you know, what am I doing wrong? I'm trying to install Linux on an iBook G3 and it's doing this, blah, blah, blah. All this information and you know, just all the contact information and everything is in here, and there is simply no easy way to get it out. There's just no export. They just don't give you that option. It's not something that they obviously want you to have. But not only do they not want you to have it, they don't give it to you. You know, they don't make it even possible. It's not that they, you know, they don't give it to you and then discourage you from using it by being such a great service. They simply don't give it to you so that you really feel like a prisoner. Why does this matter? Well, I guess it doesn't. Except that at some point, your relationship with that company changes. At first, you know, it was Gmail, and I couldn't care less. big deal. Gmail, same as Yahoo, same as Hotmail, same as, well, maybe not the same as Hotmail. But you know what I'm saying? It's just, it's a service. I get email there easily. I don't have to deal with it. Great. Solves a lot of problems. And then you get more into Linux, and you're starting to wonder about where your data lives. And you're like, well, gee, I've got all these emails, and they're just kind of floating out there with Gmail, and I don't really know where that data is going and who's looking at it and what's going to happen to it or anything like that. Start to think maybe you should have more control over your own data. And then, to add to that, you start to realize that you're not really that crazy about Google. And you start looking at some of their services, and you realize that Google doesn't really like Linux that much. And, you know, God bless them for using Linux, right? I mean, everyone says, oh, but Google uses Linux all the time. Well, fantastic. And it's great that they're employing Guido Van Rossum and that he was able to release Python 3000 whilst being employed by Google. I mean, you cannot argue with that kind of thing. You know, they're giving money to some guy and he's developing like this open source free software programming language that really in many ways brings programming to the average everyday Joe, even though I have yet to wrap my own mind around it. But apparently it's really easy. The issue is, you know, I mean, Google recently got, well, I mean, they had that Picasa thing, right? I don't even know what that is, but apparently they didn't have a Linux client for it for a long time, or maybe they still don't. I actually don't know. But the point is that they didn't support Linux at first. And then the, what was that thing? And they were saying, well, you know what it was? Chrome. It was that stupid web browser that they had. Chrome. Which everyone's forgotten about now. I even forgot the name. So they had the web browser out, right? And then you think, well, okay, cool. There's the web browser, and oh, gee, there's no Linux version. And yeah, they released the source, and from what I've heard, it was practically impossible to compile for the average person. But there you go. You know, they just didn't even bother giving it the real deal, the Linux treatment. And then, of course, there's Google Video Chat, which popped up suddenly one day on my work Mac. Suddenly there's like a little red thing saying we have video chat, so I install it, and now there's like this little camera icon by my chat name whenever the Mac is on and logged into Gmail. And so if anyone wanted to video chat me over Google Chat, yeah, I guess they could. So I thought that was pretty cool. I rushed home to install it on, you know, my Triple E, because that's my Linux computer with the webcam. Turns out, you guessed it, there's no Linux support for that. I was shocked. I mean, there's Linux support for similar Flash-based video programs, like that one video site that the Tilts guys were into for a while, Stickam, that worked on Linux fine. And yet Google can't support Linux on their video chatting protocol or whatever. It was just really, really crazy. And then there's, of course, the licensing agreement, or the EULA, on Google Docs, you know, the Google Online App Office Suite. That's just the worst agreement ever. Listen to Linux Cranks at linuxcranks.info for a lot of discussion about that. We go on and on about that. Hint, number 11. So the point is that the relationship has changed with the company, but your data is trapped. It's in their cloud, and they're not going to give it back to you unless you go through, you know, clicking on every single email you've ever done and print it to PDF or something, or copy and paste it, you know, just absurd things that obviously no one's going to be able to do. So, yeah, this is a problem. This is something that is not good, and it's something that Google probably needs to address. You know, either start supporting Linux because people are using Linux, or give people the option to get their data away from you so that they can depart. Preferably both. Well, I've been going on for a little while here, so let's part ways for a moment. Go ahead and press pause on your media player of choice or your computer. We'll part ways, we'll go get a cup of coffee, and then we will reconvene to continue the episode. Go.
Do you want to upgrade your existing computer to faster performance, insulated from viruses and spyware, and yet still have your old familiar Firefox browser, Thunderbird or web-based mail, and an office suite for your Word and Excel documents.
Whether you want to choose from the latest cutting-edge software applications from some of the world's best developers, or you want to simply continue to use many of the familiar programs you're using right now, then maybe you're ready to switch to Linux. If so, we're here to help you make that switch.
I'm Larry Bushy, the host of Going Linux.
And I'm your co-host, Tom.
Going Linux is an internet audio program, a podcast, for computer users who just want to use Linux to get things done.
Whether you are new to Linux, moving from Windows, or just Linux curious, this audio program will provide you with practical, day-to-day advice on how to use your Linux computer. Our goal is to help make the Linux experience easy for you.
Each month, we publish 3 episodes. We begin the month with a listener feedback episode. In our feedback episodes, we read listener email, play listener-generated audio, and answer listener questions.
On the third Tuesday of each month, Larry appears live on the Computer America radio show. We post those shows, minus the commercials, as Going Linux episodes.
Our user experience episodes appear near the end of each month. In them, we normally take 2 months to explore a topic related to Linux.
During the first month, we introduce the topic for new Linux users and recent converts. During month 2, we discuss the same topic from a more advanced perspective for computer users building their confidence and competence with Linux.
Come join us and see what it's all about. Our website is goinglinux.com. Thanks for listening.
One thing that kind of surprises me sometimes is the ability of people to people assume that OS X applications are so well designed, so intuitive, and it's all well and good if you are a geek and you are religiously following Mac OS X the way they do things, and you're really keeping on top of things, and you read up on how to do things, and you watch, you know, some kind of screencast or something on the subject. I mean, if you're doing all of that, well, number one, I mean, obviously what I've just described, that doesn't equal intuitive, right? It obviously means that you're doing research into something. But in the circles that I typically associate with, which is usually a pretty computer savvy crowd, I mean, not brilliant people or anything, but I mean, like, you know, people who know, who use computers a lot. In that circle, yeah, there's this illusion that it is kind of beautiful and intuitive and happy and peaceful and fun. But, you know, the minute you go out of that circle and you say, here, you know, computer noob, use this application, suddenly the intuitiveness just kind of evaporates. It's crazy. It's like what seemed so intuitive and simple to you and so well designed and with all this great marketing that they've got, suddenly it's all worthless, it's all pointless, because the person you're talking to has no idea what you're talking about. They've got no idea how to do what you're telling them to do. Case in point, the screen sharing application on Mac OS X. This is a feature that they introduced with Leopard 10.5. They call it screen sharing. And what it is just VNC. It's a way for, you know, the more savvy Mac user to share the screen, to VNC to the screen of a less savvy Mac user, so that if the noob has a question of, you know, I don't know, like, how do I throw away a document? The savvy guy can say, okay, well, here, I'll show you. Watch your screen. I'll take control of your mouse and show you. And there you go. That's the, I guess, the intention of this. The big pitch was, you know, that this was magical, that this all happened pretty much on its own. And again, if you consider you know, the noob having to open up some kind of instant messaging account if they don't have one yet. That means going to AIM.net or to Mac, the Apple proprietary or the Apple branded AIM thing, and then you have to go to the actual chat application that supports the screen sharing, and then you have to set that up by putting in your account name and your password and stuff like that, and then you have to figure out from there how to add a buddy to your buddy list. And this is all the noob doing it, right? This to you is sounding, oh, well, yeah, okay, I can do this in 5 seconds. This is someone who's needing help on using their computer and is saying, I need to screen share. And then they have to figure out, after they've added their more experienced Mac user friend to their buddy list, they need to figure out how to establish the connection or to allow the connection to be established. That's not intuitive, you know? I mean, for a lot of people, it would have been over the minute I said open an account, you know? And if they already had an account, if it's not the right, you know, if they already have an AIM account or a Mac branded AIM account, then they still have to get over the hurdle of locating their chat application, because it has to be the Mac chat application, because that's the one that supports the screen sharing, and setting that up with their account information. And that would have been the end of it right there as well. So my point is that because the marketing says that it's intuitive, and because people get excited after they learn it and say, oh, it's so intuitive, that doesn't necessarily mean it's intuitive. All that was to say that you should not be fooled by the marketing. Windows and Mac have this magical screen sharing stuff, the VNC stuff, but of course, naturally, so does Linux. And if you don't know how to do it on Linux, there was a great article a couple of months ago, maybe last year, on how to do it in GNOME and KDE by Marcel Gagné, who is the guy who writes for Linux Magazine, maybe? Or Linux... I don't think it's Linux. No, it's not Linux Journal. It's Linux Magazine or something like that. But anyway, he did a really good article on it. Sorry, I can't actually give you more specifics. But what I will do is tell you how to do it on KDE, because it's pretty easy. I dare say intuitive, after you learn it. And it's done with two different applications, one on the noob side and one on the experienced user side. The application that the noob needs to use, or if you're doing this for yourself, the application on the target computer, on the remote computer, that you would want to set up, you know, in advance. What you want to do is launch KRFB. That is KRFB. Remote Frame Buffer, I think. KDE Remote Frame Buffer. It's bizarre. But yeah, KRFB. This is the application that will open up a password and open up a port for a connection. On the remote machine, you would open up KRFB and issue, you know, an invitation to share the desktop session. That is simply clicking one button, and then it pops up and says, okay, here's your password, and here's your IP address in case you didn't know it. Just put that information into your local computer, and you'll be able to share the screen. And sure enough, on the local machine that you're going to be sitting at now that you've got your port open and your little password, and it's going to be a random password every time, and that's obviously for security. This is a unique password issued for every session, so it will be different every time. The local machine that you're sitting at now, you want to VNC into this distant remote computer. You launch an application called KRDC. I believe it stands for like remote desktop client, or KDE remote desktop client. Yes, it is. This is a really neat application because it supports VNC as well as RDP. RDP, from what I understand, is like the Windows version of VNC, and I could be totally off base on that, but that's what I'm understanding. So if you're doing it from KDE to KDE, then you can connect. There's two buttons: connect to a VNC remote desktop, connect to a Windows remote desktop. You would just click connect to VNC remote desktop. It asks you for the IP address of the machine that you want to VNC into, and the little random password. And you put that in, and suddenly you are seeing on your screen the screen of that remote computer. It's like magic. And as you can tell, it doesn't require any special account setup or any special knowledge. It's just a question of knowing what application to go to, hitting the buttons that are fairly obvious, and entering the information that it asks for. Intuitive, I guess, as much as it can be. Now, VNC, of course, if you haven't done it, I mean, it's a connection straight into that screen session. So you're going to see everything that they see. Their kicker, all the little windows that they have open, whatever. It's all right there in front of you. The speed of it is going to depend, obviously, on your network connection. The speed will also be affected by your graphics processor of your local machine. So if you've got, a local machine that can barely handle your current GUI, trying to throw this onto it as well is probably going to not be a great idea. Why would you do this? The only reason I ever do this is to remotely assist friends who have gotten into Linux who don't know how to do something. That's the only time I've ever used this. I suppose that you can do this, like, if you just want to use your computer at home from work or something. Or maybe you need to do something on your computer at home that is specifically very graphical, and you just, I can imagine that this would help doing that. Can you just SSH to the machine if you're just, doing normal stuff? Yeah, totally. Can you SSH and forward X? Yeah, totally. So that's generally what I do. Like, for myself, my personal use, I'm usually just SSHing. Sometimes SSH with forward and forwarding X. But if someone's asked me a question, how do I do such and such, and they're not getting it from, just a quick email with a delineation of the steps, then sometimes it's just quicker to VNC into their computer, show them how to do it, and get out. So there you go. That is how to remotely connect to someone else's desktop. Okay, so just a couple of things, kind of, I guess, wrapping up here. Let's see, so I inherited an old computer, an old PowerPC Mac, and, I just have to extol the virtues of Slack once again. Obviously, it was Slackintosh, there's the 12.1, Slackware 12.2 just came out, by the way, so if you're running Intel, x86 machines, and you want to try out Slackware, there's probably never a better time to try out Slackware. 12.1 and 12.2, the easiest installs you could ever imagine. When I installed 12.1, I couldn't believe how smoothly it went. It was so easy. Now, I've done some tutorials on online. I believe they're in the Lotta Linux links forum on how to set up your Slackware system. And, there are a couple of these articles online, and they're all, honestly, I didn't feel any of them really were any good, because they just would leave out the most important steps, Hopefully mine are a little bit more detailed, but unfortunately, there's always that variable of my computer acted this way, your computer might act a completely different way on some aspect of it, and I just can't tell you about that because I didn't try installing Slackware on every single computer out there. But hopefully the information I've got on there is helpful. So you can hunt that down if you want to try Slackware. But the point is that it's such an easy install now. They've got so many things included on it that it's really a beautiful thing. It just installs. I mean, literally, when I installed 12.1, everything was working out of the box. I mean, I'd never seen anything like it. So, if you want to try Slackware, trust me, it's gotten to the point where it's pretty easy to install these days. But there's still enough to be done with it. It's still highly, highly, it doesn't do stuff for you. You get to do it all yourself, and I like that. So, there's that. But anyway, Slack and Tosh for the PowerPC, Slack and Tosh 12.1 is out for that. They tend to be, you know, a little bit behind because they have to take, it's an unofficial port, so they have to take everything and port it over. So you got 12.1 Slack and Tosh, and that's what I slapped on this PowerPC box that I inherited. And I just have to say that it's just, it's a beautiful system. It really is. And I know a lot of people say that, and it's kind of an abstract idea. Let me define exactly why I believe it's a beautiful system. It has everything you need from your first install. You know, you've got one DVD, or in my case, four CDs, because this is old enough, it's so old that they wouldn't take a DVD. You got four CDs, you install a healthy amount of packages on it. This has a, it had a nice large hard drive, so I wasn't conserving space, really. I went ahead and installed quite a bit of stuff. No X, but everything else. And you've got all these things, and right during the install, you can define what services you want to start on boot. So I put web server, and because I'm going to use this as a server, web server and SSH and, you know, bind and just send mail and everything like that. And the minute you turn it on, it's just, or, you know, you reboot into Slack and Tosh. The minute you do that, just everything's running, everything's working. It's just incredible. It's so gratifying. As opposed to, you know, when I installed Debian onto it, which, you know, I love. I have Debian on my triple EPC, and I love it. But, you know, I installed that on there, and you know, SSH wasn't working automatically. I think I might have even had to install it separately, which I thought was just weird. I could be wrong on that, but so I remember something going on with SSH. You know, I mean, there's just, I don't know, there's something about Slack and Tosh where when you're installing it and you tell it exactly what you expect, you reboot and you get exactly what you told it you wanted to happen. You know, it's really nice. And yeah, there's a lot of setup that goes into it. You have to, you know, you reboot and then you make your users and stuff like that. But it's and you have to install Slack package separately from the extra folder on the install CD. But you know, there's a lot of convenient things in there, and there's a lot of really powerful tools in there, and it feels just really solid when you're setting this stuff up, and then it acts really solid after you've rebooted it. So if you're thinking about trying Slack and Slackware, or Slack and Tosh, do give it a shot. It's a really great system. But the point of that was that I'm going to be playing around with a web server, maybe an email server, things like that. I've never done a send mail email system. I've done postfix at work. I don't know if I'm really up to trying send mail. I might try to replace it with postfix. But whatever. The point is that I'm going to be playing around with a server, trying to learn a little bit about that. So if any of you think it, you know, there are server series out there already. Linux Reality did like a 10-part series on it. It's really good. If anyone thinks and feels that they would like some server information, I will be more than happy to pass on any information that I get from my experience with my server on through this show. So I guess if you're feeling in the need, if you have a special interest in that, let me know. And I'll try to concentrate on it more. If you feel like you probably know more about servers than I do, which is quite possible, then just tell me not to, you know, bother you with noob information, and I'll try to avoid the topic as much as possible. No obligation to email me. I'm just saying, like, if you care one way or the other, you certainly can. I'm open to feedback on that, because I don't want to beat a dead horse and talk about servers when every other Linux podcast has done stuff on servers, you know? That's about it for me, I think. You know, you can contact me at gort.klaatu@gmail.com for a little while, although the transition will start being made probably to something more like klaatu@linuxcranks.info. So if you want to email me at klaatu@linuxcranks.info, you are certainly welcome to do that. Get me away from Gmail. You can look at the website that I've got for this podcast at thebadapples.info. It should be friendly with text browsers as well as with graphical browsers. And remember that there is a website also called unixporn.com. That is unixporn.com, and it's not porn, it's Unix. It's a whole bunch of screenshots of people's desktops, and people keep adding to it and adding to it and adding to it. And so if you're at work and you need to, you know, get some Linux, you know, you're sitting in front of Windows or Mac or something, and all you want to see is just some Linux beauty, go to unixporn.com, if your firewall allows that. And you can gawk at people's screenshots. And there's, believe me, there's nothing pornographic about it. It's just it's a joke. It's completely innocent screenshots of people's desktops. Nothing fancy necessarily, just what they look at every day, and putting it online just to show everyone else what their setup is like. And feel free to register there and upload your own pictures as well. I'm getting the hang of the software that I'm using for that site a little bit better now. So I've upped the limit to like 5 megabytes per user, and I can up it even more later on. It's just these screenshots usually aren't that big, so it doesn't matter. But yeah, so do that. That's fun stuff. And be sure to check it out. I'm posting one from Larry Bushy from the from Going Linux, actually. He sent me one, so I'll be posting that soon. And well, you know what, I shouldn't name names, because then I'll feel obligated to name every single person who's posted. But a lot of cool people and with a lot of cool desktops have posted on there, and so you should check it out, because it's neat. You know, I mean, some of these people you might know from IRC or from another podcast or something. Some of these people you might not know at all, but at least you'll see their cool looking desktop. So there you go. That's all I've got. Thanks for listening, and I don't know, keep it between the ditches or something, you know, some catchphrase. See ya.
Thank you for listening to Radio Tinnitus. This has been Volume 3, How to Milk a Cow.